Serve It Cold, Episode 11. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Hello. Yeah, this is Helen. Well, hey there, Danny Sugar. How you doing, big man? Why are you calling me on this fine evening? Johnny C done found Narlene? That's old news. My Bobby's sister-in-law, Delphina's girl, what waits tables in the quarter, done told me that already. You behind the times, Danny Sugar. What I want to know is, she back in Catherine yet? Narlene, silly, why'd I be asking about my niece? She's not? Well, why not? You ask me, don't quite seem on the up and up or hanging around down there in the quarter after what all's happened. So how'd you hear all this, and what you reckon they up to? What? What? Danny Sugar, that don't make no sense. Nah, I don't believe it. What you suppose is Johnny doing in a fancy disguise, and why ain't Narlene with him? You don't know? Well, I couldn't say what kind of detective he is, but I heard he got a case from one of them university professors. Might could be what he's off doing right now. But it ain't right him not keeping an eye on Narlene, keeping her safe. That girl needs looking after. But how you figure this old guy you talking about is Johnny Speed? Huh. If you ain't telling me how you know things, I'm not telling you how I do. I just heard is all. No, now listen. I have a friend girl who works for those Merrymaids what cleans house, and she cleans this house out at the lake out west. She says that every evening, this guy and this gal, not his wife, mind you, get in this hot tub naked and put on a show for everybody to see. Can you believe that? They drinking and rolling around on the balcony over the lake. Donata says sometimes boats gather there and just watch. Don't you ever tell her I said she said that. I shouldn't have told you that. Well, yeah, I like to fish. Why are you asking me? So you got a boat. Well, we should mosey out to the lake some afternoon and see what we can catch.
I called Vera just as she was getting ready for bed. I gave her a synopsis of the day, and we did some storyboarding on the whole Grantham love triangle tangle until it was obvious she was starting to slip away. I tried to say goodnight to her, but of course she roused and said that she wasn't really sleepy. She had just started to slur her words again when the lights came on in the room directly across from me. I whispered a sweet dreams and broke the connection. By the time I got the cell phone stowed, Latimer had the French doors to the balcony open, and Lily was shucking out of her little black cocktail dress. When that dress hit the floor, she was finished with the job, and hurried to help Latimer peel out of his own clothes. Within 30 seconds of their arrival, I had incontrovertible evidence of marital infidelity once again, right there on the carpeted floor with the beautiful bed footboard providing a perfect background. But the couple was just getting started. It seemed that they were intent on setting a record for cycling through the entire Kama Sutra. My professional demeanor was also cycling from strictly work to erotic voyeurism to educational amazement. You know, spying on exhibitionists can hardly be called sport, and I really wanted to stop watching. I felt it was my duty to document the phenomenon. Besides, it was taking all the concentration I could spare to remember to breathe every now and then. Finally, they started to wind down. Lily slipped into a short terrycloth bathrobe and walked out onto the balcony, while Latimer disappeared into another room in the suite. Lily sat back in a wrought-iron lounge chair and opened the robe, letting the cool breeze dry the sweat from her slick body. Latimer appeared in a robe of his own and handed Lily a lit joint. Within seconds, the rich smell of ganja had drifted across the distance between us. The smoke was much richer than the usual quarter weed. In fact, it smelled very familiar. I reached out for the scope and dialed the inside of the hotel suite closer and closer. I found a small table that held a silver tea platter. Latimer had used it as a cleaning tray, and an open bag of green and purple pot lay on it. I spun the focus ring until the red pistils gleamed with THC. The Granthams were smoking Sea of Green Blueberry. I shot a few digicam shots through the scope, all the time thinking to myself that this stuff should calm them down a bit. I was mistaken. After a couple of good drags each, Latimer snuffed the joint and pulled a small vial from his robe pocket and sprinkled a dusting of white powder on Lily's nipples. She lifted her perfect right breast and licked, then sucked the powder off while Latimer did the same with the left breast. Coke? Meth? Ecstasy? Elk horn? Confectioner's sugar? Whatever the powder was, it seemed to do the trick, as Latimer joined Lily in the lounge chair where they managed a final, artful tangle of terry cloth and body parts. During this round, they seemed indifferent to each other, with Lily swinging her arms out and swooning for her imagined audience of the night, while Latimer moved behind her with silent intensity, his mouth buried into the back of her neck. His intense eyes stared straight into my darkened room. By 12:30, they had finally managed to reach the bed and lay still, the French doors still open to the first cool breeze of the fall. I carefully closed my balcony doors, pulled the thick drapes, and switched on the lights. While I checked and packed equipment, I considered the almost 6 hours until sunrise. Sleep didn't seem to be in the cards for at least a while. The Kona had done its job, and I now had a slight edgy buzz. Come to think of it, the floor show hadn't helped either. I knew from experience that if I closed my eyes and sat quietly, I could feel the midnight throb of Bourbon Street bars a scant block away as they slowly revved up the beat from a funk strut tempo of about 100 beats per minute to an electronic fizz of rave at 150 beats per minute and accelerating. I could also see the streetwalkers drift along with the thinning stream of sightseers, hear the barkers shift their spiels from crowd shouts to confidential stage whisper. "Slow night, Little John. You gotta give this new girl a try, my man." I could also see the spaghetti-strapped tees, bare bellies, and leather minis of the New England software engineers, their cheeks rosy from their first hurricanes, nipples erect in anticipation of some yahoo yelling for tits from a balcony 5 full months before Fat Tuesday. They would not be disappointed. And I could also hear my 20-year-old guardian savant, Gojo, say, "I'm real, see? Don't get into trouble." I whispered, "Yeah, Gojo, how could I possibly get into trouble? Trouble in New Orleans?" Rule number 1. When in doubt, eat. After all, the pasta course had been 6 hours before. The magic phone had me speaking to Chef Ken within seconds of my picking it up.
"Oh yes, Mr. Spade. Samuel Taylor told me you might be calling tonight. He asked me to tell you that he'll be coming off duty at 1 o'clock, and he would like you to join him for a late supper in the courtyard, if it is convenient for you."
"That'd be great. Please tell Mr. Taylor that I'll be glad to eat with him at 1.
"And what would you like to dine on this evening, Mr. Spade?"
"Do you happen to have Redback wheat beer on hand?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good, Ken. In that case, bring me 6 bottles of Redback. Please fix me whatever you're cooking for Sam, and add whatever appetizer you think would go well with the wheat beer."
"Excellent. Please allow me to congratulate you on your dinner choices, Mr. Spade."
By the time I got downstairs, Sam was already sitting in one of the courtyard's lushly planted corners. It occurred to me that the almost hidden table made a good blind for a hotel security wonk. When he saw me coming, he pulled a cell phone from his coat pocket and spoke into it. "I'm going off now. I'll talk to you in the morning." I sat down. "And if I didn't get hungry until 2 o'clock? He smiled. "Then I would have gotten off at 2 o'clock. He reached into a small cabinet hidden by a large fern and put a bottle of herb saint on the table. He held up 2 small glasses. "Have you clocked out for the night too, Johnny?" "Yes, Sam, that I have." I nodded at the herb saint as he poured over crushed ice. "Is that a North African habit you picked up?"
"Oui, it is, I guess. Of course, it's not quite the same, but some Portuguese absinthe tastes very much like our own herb saint."
He shook the glass from side to side before he handed it to me.
"It's best served very cold, as with so many things bittersweet. You know, the Swiss make a legendary absinthe. but like so many fine things, it is illegal in its own country of origin, and almost impossible to obtain. We sat quietly for a while, savoring the anise-flavored drink, enjoying the first hint of cool weather in the quarter. Then I answered, "Like genetically engineered blueberry ganja?" "Yes, exactly like blueberry ganja. Designed and developed in California, cultured and marketed from Amsterdam. Yes, exactly like that." We stared across the table for what seemed like a long time as we each weighed and balanced our pledged loyalties, our bought loyalties, the strength of a brand new friendship, and our reliance on Big John Turner's ability to judge character. At least, those are the things I thought about. Sam may very well have been thinking about sipping Swiss absinthe. He finally spoke.
"Well, I think I should tell you a story. When you arrived this evening, I surmised that you were here on a job. As security director for the guest house, it is my job to pay attention to such things, and although I truly did not and still do not want to know the details of this job, I have a responsibility to protect the privacy and the well-being of our guests and our partners. So, Johnny, when I left you tonight, I was quite conflicted. I was still conflicted when I was crossing the courtyard here, just as the cathedral bells struck midnight, and I caught the smell of marijuana in the air. As you know, the smell of ganja is as ubiquitous in the French Quarter at night as the stench of stale beer in the morning, but this wasn't the normal smell. Much heavier, more potent. It took me right back to Amsterdam. Funny how smells do that, isn't it? I would have guessed white skunk instead of blueberry, though. Well, anyway, a little pot smoke is not a big deal, but when something is going on that might attract undue attention to the guest house, such as too much loud rowdiness on the balconies, or calling down to the street to encourage pedestrians to bare their breasts, outside of Mardi Gras, of course, or even on occasion the sudden urge of our guests to bare their own bodies for the viewing pleasure of the pedestrians below. He paused and looked at me pointedly. So, when our guests draw undue attention, I can usually remedy the situation with a simple call to their room. I don't call as Samuel the Butler, but Mr. Taylor, the Royal Guest House Director of Security. In this case, I might have suggested that I send up a smoke filter to their room. It is very effective and discreet, but this method relies on my being accurate in pinpointing the exact room or balcony of the disturbance. I often make use of the fire escapes in my reconnoitering, and that is what brought me to be standing on the fire escape right outside your riverside balcony tonight, when I did indeed pinpoint the source of the blueberry ganja smoke. I was happy to find out that the guest house was not the source of the smoke, and I was happy to find out that the guest house was not the source of any other disturbance this time around. I thought that the people who caused the disturbance did look familiar, however. I can tell you that they were definitely not members of the guest house partnership. I don't know if they've been guests or not. You know, so many of them look alike.
He looked at me again. Sam, I've just got one thing to say. Damn, you can be sneaky and quiet when you want to be.
I think I'll choose to take that as a compliment, but I think you may have been a little preoccupied.
Just possibly. I let a little silence slide by and then said, Sam, I know your specialties lie along the lines of butlering, bodyguarding, and suppressing armed rebellions, but I know you worked on some surveillance jobs with Big John. Did you ever have a job that seemed just too good to be true? Good pay, everything fitting just like your client lays it out, subjects who seem to go out of their way to provide you with evidence?
No. I can't say I've ever had a job remotely resembling that.
Yeah, me either. Not until now, and it's bothering the hell out of me.
Gentlemen!
The call startled me. I looked up to see a man wearing a toque pushing a well-loaded cart across the courtyard. Chef Ken had arrived. Sam turned to me and said quietly,
Johnny, I have invited Ken to eat with us. I think you'll enjoy knowing him, and perhaps profit from it. I'm sorry to surprise you with this.
No problem, Sam. There's no better place to eat than the chef's table. After requisite introductions, Sam asked Ken,
Are you done? Cecilia, make it in.
I'm done. Celia got here about 30 minutes ago. Sam, I counted on you having herb saint tonight. Here's our first appetizer designed with it in mind. Fennel escargot pearls.
He lifted the lid on a silver bowl full of what looked like large marbles of puff pastry. I popped one in my mouth and was astounded by the earthy, licorice taste. Damn, Ken. It's a crunchy snail Rockefeller.
That's what I was looking for. Or as Samuel here would say, precisely the effect of which I was searching.
Sam took a sip of herb saint and said, Give me a break, Ken. I'm just a working stiff at the end of a very long day right now. Besides, I believe that Johnny here has also done time trying to teach the proper use of the English language to the grammatically underprivileged.
He took a pearl and studied it.
So, Chef Ken, tell Johnny what your day job is.
Now who's picking on who? Whom?
Both Sam and I were too busy chewing escargot pearls to answer. Ken continued.
Mr. Spade, what do you think my occupation is?
I took a sip of herb saint and fought the immediate craving for another pearl. Well, if these are representative of your talent, what you should be is the owner of your own French Quarter restaurant. I reached over and took one of his hands and turned it over to examine the fingertips. But you are not a full-time restaurateur. I think that when you're not creating incredible food for the Royal Guesthouse, or playing a woodwind with professional competence, you are a bail bonds enforcement officer. Ken shot a quick look that shouted betrayal towards Sam, who doubled over in laughter.
Well, Johnny, I guess you are a real detective after all. And I didn't even give you his last name. And to think, just a while ago, I was thinking you were just a run-of-the-mill peeping Tom.
He turned to Ken, still laughing.
I promise I didn't tell him anything.
If Sam didn't tell you, then how?
Would you believe me if I told you that the callus on your right thumb and the splayed fingertips show that you've spent years practicing clarinet or sax? He nodded. And would you agree that it is unusual for a chef to carry an asp instead of a meat thermometer in his smock pocket? He grinned and pulled the pen-sized weapon from his pocket, and with a flick of the wrist shot out 16 inches of chrome-plated steel.
My nighttime companion for my walk home. Very observant, Mr. Holmes, but how does carrying an asp label me as a bounty hunter? Maybe Dr. Watson over there can help with that question if we can get him out of the snails.
Sam was indeed busy finishing up the last of the pearls. He held up a finger until he finished chewing, then took a last sip of herb saint before he answered.
My good fellow, I think I can help you by giving you one critical piece of information. That information is Mr. Speed's middle name. Creedmoor.
There was a short pause as Ken turned the name over in his mind, then his face brightened.
Big John Turner, you're that Mississippi guy he was always writing about, Creedmoor Speed himself.
And you're Kenny G. Mays.
Oh, God. Okay, I get you, Johnny Speed.
Is your middle initial really G?
Not unless you can find a G in Paul. Of course, that didn't stop Big John. Okay, guys, we should be eating instead of flapping our jaws. Everybody grab a redback in memory of Big John Turner, and here is our second appetizer. Miniature fried oysters Bienville po' boys with garlic aioli.
He revealed three sandwiches cut from a thin baguette. They were incredible. This is giving me flashbacks to eating sandwiches upstairs at K. Paul's.
Yeah, I worked for Chef Paul back at Commander's in the late 70s. It's the same principle I used on the snails. I've been playing with compound butter all night trying to get the pearls just right, so when you called, this just popped in my mind as the perfect thing to eat with redback.
So, Ken, I thought you'd relocated to Houston, right?
Yeah, but I got tired of chasing Texas skips. Especially since half of them kept running over here to New Orleans anyway. I still have contacts with my bondsmen out there. Now, I just sit on my balcony and wait for the targets to walk down Bourbon Street.
Yeah, we all left at about the same time. The bad old days. It was in the late 80s. Uncle Carlos had finally been sent to prison, and the rest of the Marcello family just let the empire slip away. By 1987, everybody was fighting for a share. You couldn't walk down Bourbon Street without bumping up against wise guys from New York or Chicago, Jamaican posse members, Vietnamese ghost soldiers, and the ever-present Dixie Mafia thugs. It was just getting too hairy. I was trying to protect the high-profile bad guys from getting shot by Ken Skips. In those days, Big John was doing mostly repos. I'm sure you've heard the story. But the week he found bodies in the trunks of two of his repos, he told us it was time to hide. Both of us laughed. But within a week, John had moved to Catherine. Ken took the hint. He delivered a skip to Houston and just didn't come back. I was the hardhead. I lasted 2 months until I told my employer that he would die if he didn't find a U.S. attorney with a good witness protection plan, and I split for Europe. Did he? Die, that is? No, I was wrong. The gentleman in question is still walking these streets. But he's lost two bodyguards, a son, a wife, and a girlfriend.
The next course was a delicious guinea fowl and country-style andouille sausage gumbo, topped with cubes of raw turnip. We finished the meal with an excellent salad of fresh greens, shaved celeriac root, and smoked duck breast with balsamic vinaigrette, and large gouts of Maytag blue cheese. We sat and talked of Big John Turner, jazz, skip tracing, and repo work. We drank beer, we talked about leaving town and homecoming, about Cajun food and Zydeco music, and we drank some beer. We talked about life in Catherine, Mississippi. We talked about everything that wandered into our pastis and beer-drenched minds, except that other Catherine, Lake Catherine, or the Rigolets, or the damn Pearl River marshes. But I already had the feeling that I was going to spend a portion of the night in a skiff full of dead and dying drug runners. After a while, Ken rose and said goodnight. A while later, I pulled myself up and followed suit, shuffling across the courtyard and leaving Samuel Coleridge Taylor sitting in his hidden corner. There was nothing left for me to do but find my sleeping alcove, crawl into that fancy bed, and fulfill my own rotten prediction. Get it done.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.